and reading about fictional psychopaths because they're so complex. What are their reasons for doing the things they do? Sometimes they have a moral code and actually feel what they're doing is right. Such as Dexter Morgan killing murderers. What a good guy. And other times they're just straight up psycho. Also, what makes psychopaths so terrifying is that they're real. Maybe there aren't actually dark wizards mass murdering innocent muggles in this world, but psychopaths are very much a reality, and they could be anybody. I bet Julian Powell's friends, teachers, schoolmates, and neighbors had no idea about the messed up tornado swirling around in his head. So maybe I should rephrase that first line. I love Julian Powell. My favorite things about Julian breaks every rule. How straightforward Julian is. He never lies to you about what he's done or what he's thinking, which made him feel like a way more reliable narrator than you typically get with psychopaths. But it also begged the question of whether he was telling the truth, which caused me to have a bit of a crisis. What if he was lying the whole time? I got very into it, not gonna lie. The constant foreshadowing really helped build suspense in the story, because no matter how much information it seems like Julian is giving away, you really don't know the ending until you get there. Upon reading the story a second, third, and fourth time, I learned a lot about what was actually going on. Julian is very much a typical psychopath, but he has some pretty clear differences as well. Normal psychopaths, obviously, don't have powers that allow them to kill people with their minds. But Julian does. Or does he? Are those deaths just coincidences? Whatever the case, the intent behind his actions mirrors that of a regular psychopathic murderer. He believes somebody deserves to die, and it happens. As for Julian's ability to get away with anything, it's a pretty well-known fact that psychopaths are master manipulators and can essentially talk their way out of anything. Seriously, have you seen Dexter? So it shouldn't come as a surprise that Julian can get away with murder, literally or figuratively, and break any rule as well. To me, Julian felt like a normal teenager. Who hasn't, in a fit of rage, wished someone dead? But for average teens, it doesn't actually happen. At least, I hope not. And just like any other guy his age, he faces awkwardness around girls, jerks from school, and the stresses of hosting a party. Julian's inner voice remained very light-hearted throughout the story, which was a great contrast to his sinister thoughts and behavior. He also didn't stick to any moral code like Dexter does, which dehumanized Julian a bit and made him more frightening. Despite all this, I was completely on his side the entire time. This is a slightly terrifying thought when you're reading about a psychopathic killer, but I often find myself rooting for the villains. Speaking of Julian being a stone-cold killer, the ending of this story knocked my socks off. Here I was thinking Julian would remain a quasi-telepathic murderer until the end of his days, but nay, this is the day when he plans to take control at last and kill the hated Stephen Kemple with his own two hands. I didn't see that coming, and it had me itching to flip to the next page to find out what happened. But there was no more. Touché, Mr. Smith. Touché. Although this story left me with plenty of questions, it also provided me with a lot of ideas and theories. Does Julian actually go through with killing Stephen? We'll never know. How far can he push his power of manipulation? To the moon, perhaps. The openness of the ending hurt my soul just a little bit. but it was the perfect note on which to end the story. Strange, suspenseful, and definitely psychopathic, Julian Powell is a teen psycho extraordinaire. Indigo and Shade by April Genevieve Tucholka. I didn't believe the beast was back. Not at first. No one did. The red-headed Bella Rose twins claimed they saw it roaring in the moonlight at the edge of the hush woods. They said it was 10 feet long, with 6-inch teeth, and it seemed to worship the night, whatever the hell that meant. They said they took off running and barely escaped with their lives. I just laughed in their faces. I was sure they'd seen a bear or wolf or something else furry and large, and got so scared, the cowards, that their reason and common sense shut down, and their craven 16-year-old brains conjured up a monster. People in the Rocky Mountains had been trying to kill the beast since the Colorado Gold Rush. It would appear, slaughter a few kids, and then vanish again. On and on and on for the last 150 years. It had all happened before, and it would all happen again. Unless I could stop it. I'd been waiting for the beast to return to our woods since I first learned how to use a bow. I practiced archery hour after hour while other kids did stupid, unheroic things like kick balls and fall off skateboards and take piano lessons. I was ready. I was born for this. It would be stopped right here, right now, by me. 3 nights after the Bella Rose twins said they saw the creature, 3 nights after I laughed them off and called them cowards, I saw the beast for the first time. I was night hunting in the hush woods. I felt my skin prickle, instinct, basic and primal. I froze in my tracks and looked up, and there it was, crouching over a fresh kill, teeth ripping into a deer, bones crunching, blood spraying. There isn't a cowardly bone in my body. I didn't run like the twins. I sucked in my breath, slipped lithely and shadowy behind a tall pine tree, and watched the creature that had killed so many people, the creature that had loomed so large in my imagination since I was a little kid. The beast was lupine in shape, broad nose, short ears, angular limbs, soft-looking fur. But there was something sentient about it, too. Sentient and savvy. It seemed aware. The animal tore off the deer's hind leg in one hard jerk, held it in its mouth, and sniffed the air. It turned and looked at me, straight at me. I'd watched a lot of animals in the woods, killed them too. I knew them, knew their emotions. I'd stared into their eyes and seen surprise and hunger and fear and indifference, but I'd never seen anything like the beast's. Its eyes were sad, lonely, angry, proud. Human. I should have knocked my arrow. I should have shot it. Whoosh, slice, fur parting, skin tearing, muscles ripping. This was my moment. Instead, I called out, "Who are you?" The beast flinched at the sound of my voice, gaze still locked with mine. We both watched each other for 1 second, 2, 3, and then it bolted through the trees, deer leg tucked between its jaws. I didn't tell a soul. I was Brahm Valois, after all, heir to the Valois fortune, and not some idiot, red-headed twin. I couldn't tell people I'd seen the beast bloodily eating a deer in a cursed patch of Colorado woods and then had let it go. People were counting on me. They were expecting me to do what no one else had ever done. kill the beast. I dreamed about it every night since then. But in my dreams, the beast didn't run away. It just tilted its head back and howled. Someday I would put an arrow through its heart. I think it had known. I think it had seen this in my eyes. I held its fate in my hands, and it had run away. Valois is a rich ski resort town in Colorado. It's also my last name. That's right. My ancestor founded this town. My great-great-great-grandfather pissed off a French lord 150 years ago. They hunted down Jean-Georges Valois and threw him off a cliff. But he lived. The Valois men are survivors. He booked passage on a ship to America and then followed the gold rush up into the Rocky Mountains. My family has never lacked ambition. When Jean-Georges' claim dried up, he paved roads and built hotels and saloons and churches. Then, when he was in his 90s, he built the first ski resort in the Rockies. The wealthy followed. I have 14 cousins and 3 brothers, and I'm the oldest male. And I could have ended up one of those spineless, sniveling, special snowflake trust fund kids, but my dad is Brom Valois the First, and he didn't raise spoiled pansy boys. I've camped in freezing temps, in 10-foot snow. I killed my first buck when I was 5, and then helped skin it afterward. I spent my summers at hardcore wilderness survival camps, where I was dropped in the woods alone for a week, with nothing but the clothes on my back and a hunting knife. I spend my days in 5-star restaurants with pretentious 1-word names, but I have also eaten squirrel and possum and jackrabbit and swamp rat. I have nibbled on frog legs, roasted over a spit in the wild, as well as fried in panko and served with lemon, grass-fed butter, and frites at the downtown Fourchette restaurant. I saved our town from a forest fire 2 years ago. Me and my younger brothers, Jean-Georges, Philippe, and Luc, were in the front lines, battling the flames day and night, no sleep. We turned the tide. We saved our town and Broken Bridge, the other rich ski resort 20 miles over. We rescued half the county from the burning inferno. We were heroes. Me and my brothers owned Valois, ran Valois, saved Valois, and my life could have gone on like this forever and forever for all I cared. Once I killed the beast, I'd have everything I wanted from life and could just coast on a wave of glory and self-fulfillment until the end. That was how it was supposed to go, anyway. And then I met Indigo. The first time I saw Indigo Beau, she was sitting smack in the middle of the hush woods, not half a mile from where I saw the beast a few weeks before. I was half naked, stripped to my waist, wearing nothing but my muscled abs and my designer jeans and my recurve bow. I liked to slay creatures the way my French ancestors used to in their dark, black forests hundreds of years ago. Just me and sky and trees and arrows. Indigo gasped when she saw me. Of course she did. I have gorgeous blonde hair, thick and glossy. It curls up at the ends like little twists of sunshine. I have sea-green eyes and healthy, glowing skin. I'd been running and hunting and fighting since I was a kid, and I looked like a god. Tight waist, long legs, big pecs, boom, boom, boom. Indigo was nestled into a pile of green ferns and a slanting stretch of sunshine. She had thick brown hair that draped halfway down her back, and she wore a yellow dress with a long blue scarf folded around her neck. She had a book in her lap, sky blue cover with a red moon in the center. I stared at her, rooted to the spot, hunter and prey. There was something unnerving about her. I noticed it straight off. The way she sat in those ferns, pliant and nimble, but also tense. I thought maybe she was a dancer. I'd been to NYC and seen ballet. The Valois boys were cultured, even if we did live on a mountain. There was something of those sinewy ballerinas about her. "Bonjour, ma belle," I said finally, in my sexiest, Frenchiest voice. Her gaze lingered over me, and I let it. I was used to this kind of attention. I rolled my neck and then my shoulders, like I was sore from hunting primevally with my bow in the savage wilderness. She stood up and raised her face to mine. Her eyes were a light, pearly blue, and they were sparkly and bright, but with something deep in them, too. Deep and melancholic. She had a sweet, heart-shaped face and high arched eyebrows and plump lips. She was gorgeous. I dated prettier, but not often. I smiled at her, my 1,000-watt Valois grin, but her body stayed tense and strained, as if I were an unpredictable wild creature that might attack at any moment, rather than a glorious specimen of refined masculinity. Her eyes kept shifting to my bow, like it made her uneasy, like she could see the ghosts of all the animals I'd slain lining up behind me. All right, then. Time to get civilized. "Hello there, stranger. I'm Brom Valois the Second. Valois, like the town." She stood up and put her palm in mine. She shook firm and quick, and then pulled her hand away and went back to clutching her book. She still hadn't said a word. She looked at my bow again. I narrowed my eyes. "I hope you aren't one of those tree-hugging vegan types, because I'm a hunter and proud of it."
"I'm not."
"Not what?"
"A tree-hugging vegan."
"Good." I relaxed and flashed her another Valois smile. "Is that a romance?" I nodded my chin at her little novel. She shook her head, and her long, dark hair swished side to side. "What then, a book of spells? Are you reading about herbs and potions and boiling cauldrons? Because a girl would only hide in the woods to read a really dirty romance or some New Age Wiccan piece of trash spell book." She laughed. She had a nice laugh. A lot of girls don't. A lot of the girls I'd been with had laughs that were feeble or fake or forced, but hers, it was genuine. Genuine and fierce as a Rocky Mountain winter snowstorm that dumped 3 feet of snow in 24 hours.
"I'm Indigo Beau," she said, and her voice was genuine and fierce, too.
She sat back down in her patch of ferns, and I plopped to the ground next to her, dropping my bow and arrows off to the side. I held out my hand, and she gave me the book. It had a vague title, The Lone Hunt. I flipped through it, expecting to find a steamy sex scene or an illustration of smug-looking women standing on a hill in the middle of a thunderstorm, chanting a spell about sisterhood. But it was a non-fiction book about wolves, their habits, descriptions of their dens, pack dynamics. I handed the book back to her. "Why are you reading about wolves?" She shrugged, shoulders nestling into her blue scarf.
"I'm interested."
"So, you in town for a while? Let me guess. Your dad is a minor celebrity, like a professional golfer, and your family came here to rub elbows with the rich." She just smiled, her chubby lips tilting up in a pretty way. "I figured. That's why you don't know about these woods. Me and my brothers are the only people around here brave enough to walk through them." I pointed at a big dead oak, 24 yards in front of us, its gray branches spreading out into the sky. 100-odd years ago, they hanged 3 women from that tree, and now no one will go near this spot. They call it Hush Witch Glen. This wasn't the whole story. People thought the woods were haunted, sure, but they didn't go in them because of the beast.
I didn't want to scare her, though. Not yet. Indigo glanced around as if searching for ghosts, blue eyes moving from shadow to shadow. The wind picked up suddenly and burst through the trees, shaking all the leaves at once. It was early October, and the rustling was loud and crisp. "I always get goosebumps when the wind does that," she said. "It swoops up out of nowhere, almost as if it's listening in on our conversation and wants us to know." Indigo ran her hand down her arm. She did have goosebumps. I could see them. "Yeah, the hush woods are an eerie place. People are right to stay away." The wind swooped in again as I said this. Indigo pointed at my forearm, and now I had goosebumps too. I never get goosebumps. When that coyote pack was hunting near my tent in Oregon and howling in my ears all night long, I was calm as the night sky. When I stumbled upon a baby grizzly outside Banff, Canada, and had to scrabble 30 feet up a tree to get away from its mother, my heart barely skipped a beat. Indigo tilted her head, and her cheeks fell into a ray of dying sun. Her hair almost touched the ground, and it was straight and natural and soft-looking. I watched her for a second, kind of awed by her beauty. She batted her eyes at the sunlight, shaded her face with her hand, and looked at me again. "Did they really hang 3 women here?" "Yes. My great-great-great-grandfather, Jean-Georges, hushed it up, which is why this part of the Rockies is called the Hush Woods. But it happened. Ask anyone." "Why were they hanged?" Indigo hadn't said much so far, and I was doing all the talking, and that was fine by me. I really didn't want to ruin the nice, quiet moment by talking about the beast, but dodging her questions was just going to make her more curious in the end. That's how girls work. I hooked an elbow around one bent knee and ran a hand through my golden curls. It was during the Colorado Gold Rush. A group of good-time gals from the saloons formed a league promoting the rights of women. They wanted to vote and own property and get equal treatment. They held rallies and fundraisers and tried to get laws passed, but behind their backs, everyone called them the Valois Coven. The sun was dipping down, and it was getting chilly. I didn't want to shiver in front of this new girl, but I was half-naked, and it was taking some concentration to appear indifferent to the cold every time an autumn hush breeze blew down my spine. "Go on," she said, blue eyes sparkling. "What happened next?" She was really interested in what I was saying. Of course she was. "Well, fighting for women's rights in a gold rush town made of 90% men is not going to end well, and it didn't. The good-time women in Broken Bridge joined the coven, I mean the league, and their numbers grew. And then a boy went missing. He was only 14, son of the mayor. They found the kid's body in the woods a few days later, and it looked like it had been chewed on, and not by the usual critters like coyotes and wolves and cougars, but something else. Something more delicate and precise. Something had crushed his lungs and ripped out his damn heart." Indigo flinched. "Another boy went missing, and then a girl. Finally, Jean-Georges Valois had the 3 leaders of the coven arrested. He called in a corrupt priest to officially declare them night witches. The whole town came out. They threw rocks at the women until they fell to their knees, and then they strung them up and watched them hang for sorcery and murder. Mob mentality. It's a terrible thing." Indigo nodded, eyes big, too moved by my gripping story to talk, no doubt. I am a natural-born storyteller, one of the many talents that run in my family. Of course, hanging the lead witches didn't stop the bodies from turning up in this forest. There were 2 more after the first batch, but J.G. Valois kept it out of the papers by shooting the only journalist in the Rockies reckless enough to investigate. Indigo flinched again. Did I feel a twinge then? A minuscule twinge of regret? Maybe. But I was proud of being a Valois. So what if my ancestor hanged some innocent women a long time ago to keep the peace? Who didn't have skeletons in the family closet? Indigo was still just watching me with her big blue eyes. To this day, bodies are still found once in a while, chewed up and mangled. I sighed and rubbed my palm along my jaw. A decade will pass, maybe two, and people start dying again. Here it came. A beast lives in these woods, Indigo. A beast that hunts and kills humans. Whenever it rains too much, or too little, or whenever a bad flu sweeps through, or a wolf pack starts skulking too close to town, or when the moon shines too full or too bright, they say the Hushwoods beast is back again and on the prowl. The Bellarose twins claimed to have seen it a few weeks ago, and I laughed it off. But then, Indigo screamed. I jumped to my feet, grabbed my bow, spun around. Nothing. I knocked an arrow, slowed my breath. Nothing. Nothing but sky and trees and ferns and quiet. Indigo slammed her hands over her ears and screamed again. The sound was sad and soft and chilling. I got goosebumps, twice in one day. I moved closer to her and kept my stance low, my bow ready. "What's wrong? What did you see?" She just shook her head. "Indigo, why are you screaming?" She shook her head again. The wind picked up, and suddenly I thought I could hear those women crying out as the noose went around their necks. I heard them pleading their innocence, while the crowd screamed for their blood. Then I heard a crack, and another, and then silence. She smashed her hands over her ears again. "Can't you hear it? It's faint, behind the wind and the leaves. It's like having a song stuck in your head, a haunting, terrible song." I stared at her. I certainly didn't hear anything, and I certainly didn't want to believe her. The beast was real, yes. Everyone effing knew that. But the Hush Witch ghosts? Dead is dead. Of course, I hadn't believed the twins about the beast, and then I'd been proved wrong. But that didn't mean I'd be proved wrong again. It was really unlikely, actually. I sat back down and put my arm around Indigo's waist. She lowered her hands from her ears. Her eyes were wet with tears. Girls cry so easily. "Maybe I imagined it," she said. I nodded. "Of course you did. But this is an eerie place, Indigo. You shouldn't come here again without someone like me to protect you. I mean it."
"Brahm?"
"Yeah?"
"I don't want to be hanged like those women. I don't want to die with a noose around my neck. Snap. Pain. Feet twitching. Dark."
I shivered when she said that. Probably from the cold. "What a strange thing to worry about," I said. "People don't get hanged anymore. If you want to worry about something, worry about the Hush Woods beast. You really shouldn't be out here on your own, even in the daytime." Indigo didn't answer. She slid the thick blue scarf from her neck and wrapped it around both our shoulders like a shawl. It was warm from her skin and smelled like lavender and honey. "Indigo, I'm going to take you to dinner tomorrow night. What do you like? Seafood, Italian, French, Thai?" She shook her head. "Are you a food cart type of girl? Want to get fish tacos and crepes?"
Chin, left to right.
"Well, what do you want then?"
"I can't go to dinner with you."
"All right, we'll go to a movie."
"No."
"No?"
"No, I can't." This was the first time a girl had ever told me no.
I didn't know how to handle it, honestly. "You can't go, or you won't go?" I sounded annoyed and kind of pissed. Everything was really tense all of a sudden. We both just stared at the sky for a bit, not talking. It was starting to turn pink and orange and purple. Sunset. I felt her jerk suddenly, her shoulders snapping against mine. She stood up.
I have to leave.
All right, I'll walk you home. It was a good 3 miles back to town, even with the shortcuts I'd honed through the years. She shook her head again.
Look, I'm not trying to hit on you, since I can see you're not interested somehow, but the hush woods are dangerous at night. Let me walk you home.
I am home, she said. And just at that second, the setting sun blazed up right in my face and blinded me. I rubbed my eyes. When I opened them, she was gone. It was usually easy for me to forget about girls. Far too easy. I had a lot of distractions, but I couldn't stop thinking about Indigo Beau after I saw her in the woods. She'd crawled into my brain, and I couldn't get her out. I expected to see her around town the next few days. Valois is small. Small enough that eventually you run into people. I asked around about her at the coffee shops and some of the restaurants to see if anyone knew where she lived, but that went nowhere. I even spent a few hours hanging out in the downtown library to see if she'd come in looking for more books on wolves. Nothing. So I went back to the hush woods. I waited until evening, right before dusk, and I found her reading in the glen, sitting in the ferns, just like before. She didn't look surprised to see me. I sat down next to her, and we talked. We talked about our siblings. She had 4 sisters to my 3 brothers. We talked about books and wolves and trees and places I'd been and places she wanted to see. The sun dipped lower, and Indigo heard the witch screams again. I held her this time, and she let me. I went back the next night, and the next, night after night. Afterward, she never let me walk her home. She'd just disappear between one breath and the next. I'd close my eyes for a second, and when I'd open them, she'd be gone. Someday she would trust me enough to let me in on all her secrets. On the 7th night, I kissed her. Plump, warm lips sliding into mine. I lifted her hair with the back of my hand and kissed her neck. She opened the front of my shirt and kissed my collarbone. I groaned, and she grabbed my hair in her fists. I tried to warn Indigo about the beast again. I tried to get her to meet me in town instead of the hush woods, but she'd only shake her head and smile kind of sadly. Autumn crept into winter. During the day, I hunted buck and antelope and mule deer with my younger brothers, arrows cutting through air into flesh, bringing moans and blood. I spent a lot of nights roaring drunk at the Valois watering hole, beating up anyone stupid enough to challenge me. I even tried to fight some emaciated hipsters once, with their tight jeans and stupid beards and pretentious talk about small-batch micro-brews, but they scuttled away before I could throw a punch. Philippe was the first to call me out on it. He told Jean-Georges and Luke I was meeting a girl in the woods. How he'd figured it out, I never knew. He told them I was in love. They teased me, and my temper sparked, and the 4 of us ended up breaking 2 mirrors, a glass table, and my mother's damn Rococo Cupid statue. Brom Valois the First took away my credit cards and my black BMW. And yet, I hardly cared. I was in love. Philippe was right about that. I was in love with Indigo Beau. And life could have gone on like this forever and ever. And then they found the body. A girl, 14, soccer player, straight-A student, and daughter of Marie and John Jasper, owners of the best French bakery in town. Some tourist hikers stumbled upon the corpse at the edge of the hush woods. Her heart had been ripped out. Indigo Beau lived in the hush woods, and the beast was on the prowl.
I felt sick at the thought of her in that forest with it. Sick. It had been almost 15 years since the beast had killed someone in the Hush Woods. No one had believed the Bella Rose twins when they'd said it was back. But they would have believed me. I should have told someone. The people of Valois had tried to kill the beast in the past. Of course they had. But it was always too clever, too fast, too cunning. Generation after generation, and still the beast lived. But now it would be different. Now they had me. I was the best tracker in Valois, next to my father. I wouldn't let the beast go this time. I would track it, hunt it down, put an arrow through its heart. I'd free my town from this curse. I was born for this. I'd become the town hero twice over. I'd march back into Valois, dragging the beast's body behind me. I'd save Indigo Beau from the Hush Woods beast, and we'd live happily ever after. This is what will happen. I could feel it in my bones. I went to Hush Witch Glen at sunset, but Indigo wasn't there. I waited over an hour, but she never came. I was starting to get worried, really, really worried. The moon rose high and fat in the sky. I went back to town and grabbed my cloak and my recurve bow. Yes, I own a black wool cloak. Philippe tried to make fun of me for it once, and I broke his arm. I strode past the local beast hunters gathering in the town square, mapping out their attack. They'd never find the monster. It would come down to me, and me alone. It had rained the night before, and I took it as a sign. The mud was going to help me fulfill my destiny. I found the tracks near midnight. 4 toes, 4 claws, just like a wolf. I stretched out my fingers next to the print. It was the size of my hand. The wind had a spooky feel to it, sharp and cold, bite and teeth. But it was more than that, too. I thought for a second I could hear voices. No, screams. Was this what Indigo kept hearing? Was this the cry of the hanged women? If there were ghosts in these woods, then they'd have it in for a Valois, after what my ancestor had done. The screams seemed to float around me like feathers falling from the sky. Goosebumps rippled down my arms and down my spine. That was when the doubt set in. Maybe I wouldn't kill the beast. Maybe it would kill me. I'd never felt doubt before. The Valois men didn't feel doubt. We didn't even know what it was. Lights. The other hunters were moving through the trees half a mile away, flashlights bouncing off the dark. Normally, they wouldn't dream of coming near the Hush Woods border, but now a 14-year-old girl was dead. That gave people courage. Vengeance is a brilliant motivator. Not that it would help them. They were too loud, too slow. The beast would see them coming a mile away, just as I had. The witch screams quieted down just as the wind picked up again. I sniffed the air. There was a new smell to it, metallic and pungent. I spun around. The beast was tearing into a coyote, fur and paws and nose and gore. I'm not squeamish. That's for pansies. But the scene was harsh. Cannibalistic. I looked away, up at the sky. The moon was bright red-orange now, like it was made of embers and glowing warm. Everything smelled like blood. I knocked my arrow. The brick-colored moon shone down, as if leading my hand. I didn't make one effing sound. I was silent as the stars. I took aim. I rarely miss. When I shoot, it's to kill. But the beast looked up as I pulled back the arrow. It looked right at me. It tensed as if to run. But at the last second, it stopped. Stopped. Something about its eyes, its expression. It was almost as if the monster was begging me to strike. My arrow flew. It whistled through the air, nicked its shoulder, smacked into a tree. I'd missed. The beast tilted its head back and howled. And then it began to change. Fur melted into white-blue moonlight skin, paws pressed into the earth and dissolved into hands, fingers, feet, toes. Long spine twisted, curved, and softened into a back, a waist, hips. Indigo sat naked on the muddy ground next to the mauled coyote. Her brown hair hung in her face, and her shoulder dripped blood. I called out her name, but her eyes were already on mine. She looked fierce and proud and sad. I took off my cloak and threw it around her body. She reached up and wiped blood from her mouth and teeth. "So," I said, "it's you." She just nodded. "Tell me." And she did. She sat there naked in the forest, smelling of night and earth and fur, and told me about her family and its curse. "One girl in every generation becomes a shade," she said. "That's what my family calls the beast. The sun sets, and we shift. We hunt and kill like an animal. The shade picked me, the youngest, out of 5 sisters. I turned 14, and it began." Indigo pressed her back into my chest. She was nestled into my arms, her head on my shoulder. "My parents let me stay with them for as long as they could. We were careful. We lived outside town on a farm in Minnesota. I quit school. No one knew. I thought I could control it. I thought a lot of things. My parents tried chaining me up, but I always broke free. I'm so strong, Brahm. So strong. And then one moonlit night, I mauled a boy. They found his body 6 days later. His name was Ethan. He used to be in my class in school. I'd known him since kindergarten." Indigo started crying, her back trembling against my chest. I held her. I put my face in her hair and held her until the sobs slowed down and she was breathing normal again. "My aunt was here in the hush woods before me," she whispered when she could talk. "And her cousin before that. The locals don't like to come to this forest, as you said, so it's safe. Safer. There's a cabin hidden deep in the trees where she lived. That's where I live now. My aunt took her own life. She was only 22. She couldn't bear it. We all find our way to death eventually." Indigo's shoulder was still bleeding, but every time I moved to staunch the blood, she just clutched me tighter. "I will kill again," she said, "and I will keep killing until someone stops me." They found us an hour later. We saw their flashlights first, white lights casting long shadows across the forest floor. She got to her feet, naked except for my cloak. I stood at her side. They saw the blood and the coyote, and they knew. People aren't as dumb as you think. They aren't as dumb as you want them to be. John Jasper stood at the head of the group. He looked at me and nodded, just once. "We're going to kill her. We're going to end this. Try to stop us, and we'll kill you too, Valois." I saw the rope in his hand, the noose at the end. Indigo shrank from it. I felt her recoil against me. My bow was 10 feet away, right where I'd dropped it in the mud. "Change," I whispered to her. "Change into the beast and run. Run, Indigo." "I can't," her voice caught. She shook her head, cleared her throat. "It doesn't work that way." My eyes met hers. She nodded. I nodded back. They won't string her up like one of those 3 Valois women. I could give her that much, at least. The mob drew in, thick and tight. They started with rocks. I turned and threw myself in front of Indigo, long arms, broad shoulders, brawny back. The blows fell on me and me alone. I'm built like an ox. I didn't feel the stones, didn't feel the bruises. She crouched beneath me in the dark. She matched her breath to mine, slow, steady, soft. I reached down and pulled the Bowie knife from the straps around my left calf. She grabbed my shirt in her fist and squeezed tight. "Do it," she said. I cupped her tiny, pointed chin in my large hunter's hand and tilted her head back. I slit her throat. She slipped to the ground. I turned back to the crowd and dropped the knife. The mob took a step back, waiting to see what I'd do next. But I just slid down beside Indigo Bow, slid into the blood and the mud. The crowd left. My brothers found me near dawn. They helped me up, arms supporting my weight. "My bow," I said to Philippe. He fetched it, handed it to me. I pulled the string back, muscles straining. I knocked the arrow and shot Indigo Bow's limp body straight through the heart. I am the new Valois beast. My hair is long and tangled, my beard thick, my clothes ragged. I sleep in dirt and old leaves. I hunt and I eat what I kill. People scream when they see me in the woods. That's as it should be. I wait for her. I wait for the next beast. I know she will come. 5 years, 10 years. Sooner or later, she will come. But this time, she won't be alone. This time, she will have me. Whitney Atkinson's Villain Challenge to April Genevieve Tucholke. Beauty and the Beast, Suitor's Revenge. Glamorized Recovery, Expectations versus Reality, by Whitney Atkinson. Is Gaston cursed to be forever known as the villain? The answer is yes, not because of fate or luck, but because of his choices. The world seems pitted against villains, whereas heroes get success, love interests, and unblemished reputations practically handed to them, villains are forced to put sweat and blood into each of their endeavors, a process that makes villains seem like they succumb to the pressures of life, whereas heroes twist misadventures to benefit them. If you were a villain, you would see firsthand how the gears of a hierarchical society work, rewarding the minor endeavors of heroes and punishing the slight advancement of villains. Perhaps your expectations, pure at heart, would be thwarted in a burst of smoke. So imagine yourself in Gaston's shoes. You might think the following. Expectation. You get the girl. Reality. Your heart swells the first time you see her. Darkness has reigned for so long that this new sensation overwhelming your chest feels like an unsolicited invasion. Yet you feel compelled to talk to her. You do. Your heart quivers, then cracks, seeping into the once hollow chasm of your chest. You are bleeding with emotion, fingertips tingling and vision dancing, but then she looks away. She can't be yours. She distances herself from you, and the once quaking center of your chest crushes to an insatiable emptiness, only ever slightly mollified by the urge for revenge. Expectation. You are accomplished at every skill you try. Reality. You spend meticulous hours perfecting your craft, honing your sense of purpose, and extinguishing any thoughts of imperfection. If only the girl could see how much better you are than her lover. A blade sheathed at your side feels like a loving hand there to grasp when you're feeling unsure. The wicked gleam grows in your eyes each time your knife finds the perfect mark. each time you add another tick to your body count. You notice how the townsmen cheer at the young man who has proven himself as the city's most revered and experienced hunter as you laugh, an isolated sound in a desolate wood crouched in the puddle of blood surrounding your most recent kill. The irony is an iron fist in your gut. Expectation. You are loved by everyone. Reality. Eccentricity drives you to madness. Nights are spent, sleeves rolled up, elbow deep in ink of nights toiling beneath shrouds of darkness, plotting. Darkness has become the only embrace you ever feel warmly enveloped in. All of your friendships have tapered to the single fact that when you are standing in a room full of other people, the atmosphere grows so thick it is almost as if you can feel those around you compartmentalizing in their minds all of the other places that they would rather be. Expectation. Every issue has a smooth, clear, and triumphant solution. Reality. Every failed attempt, every scornful gaze, every rejection, every shortcoming collects and settles in the gape that occupies your chest. You become heavy with hatred, lethargic, and dripping with disgust. Your blood and sweat stains the soles of your boots and leaves a trail of toiling everywhere you go. But you are still resented and alienated. Your status creates an impermeable shell around your existence, driving you further into exile, but this time via a prison of your own making. Your brain has degenerated so completely that if any shred of the old, enthusiastic you remains, it must be smothered. So if that's what's inside the mind of a villain, what do heroes deal with? Interestingly, the answer is the same struggles, except they overcome. They conquer. Villains and heroes are chillingly more similar in that respect than a lot of people realize. The difference is that villains get stuck sometime during the battle. They succumb to the challenges they face, regardless of whether it is their own fault or due to the circumstances they are trapped in. There is something painfully relatable in the failure to overcome hardship and to have that disappointment fester within you. In this way, heroes represent success, the acquisition of true love, and a prosperous future, whereas villains embrace the more realistic and less glamorized version of our reality, a world in which not every problem can be solved with a sweep of a magic wand or true love's kiss.
Sarah by Nicola Yoon. 1. Present day. The detective pulls his eyes away from Karina Thomas, the woman he's questioning. The lurid graphics and logos of CNN breaking news demand his attention. Usually they don't have the television on in the interrogation room, but it's been an unusual day. He turns up the volume. The news anchor's voice strives to be calm and dignified, but doesn't quite achieve it. He sounds somewhere between panicked and excited. Panic is winning out. In the upper right quadrant of the screen, a girl is marching slowly down the middle of Interstate 10, a major Los Angeles highway that runs east to west. All around the girl is fire. Every car in her vicinity is either in flames or a smoldering, burned-out husk. The quadrant expands to full screen and pushes the anchor's frightened face out of view. The girl has become a familiar sight over the last 12 hours. The media has dubbed her Soldier Girl because she's covered head to toe in camouflage. And because she doesn't simply walk, she marches like a general leading an army to war. Though she's being followed by a gang of men, they are not soldiers, and they are killing one another. The news helicopter above doesn't dare get too close. CNN has already lost two helicopters to inexplicable crashes. The other reason the helicopter doesn't get too close is the bodies. Decency says you can't show that kind of carnage on American television. The drivers, the commuters, the beachgoers, the unlucky travelers who happened to be on the 10 that day, are not dying by fire. They are dying by fist. They are bludgeoning one another to death. They hit until their knuckles bleed, until white bone gleams, until teeth are loosened and spit out, until external injuries become internal ones. They beat one another until the world hemorrhages blood. One more thing about the bodies. They are all men. Every single one. The detective forces his eyes back to the woman in front of him. He'd met her once before, when she was a young mother. She and her daughters had narrowly escaped the clutches of a serial killer. It wasn't his case, but it was a strange one. Strange enough that he'd never forgotten it, or her daughters. The younger one, in particular. Tonight, when they brought Karina Thomas in, she reminded him of their previous meeting. The mother said, "Then you already know. You already know about my daughter." At the time, he didn't know what to think or believe. Her older daughter, Calliope, had just died. She had set herself on fire. Or she was set on fire. It was his job to figure out which. But Karina Thomas was sure. She said, "It was Sarah. Sarah killed her." Of course he didn't believe her. Whoever heard of a 14-year-old girl killing her older sister by setting her on fire? No. He'd seen bad things over the years. But mostly men did the bad things, not little girls. But that was 12 hours ago, before people started killing one another on a massive scale. No, not people. Only men. First a street, then a neighborhood. If it continued, all the men of this city would die at one another's hands. And who was at the center of it all? Who was walking down the I-10? This woman's daughter, Sarah. Eyewitnesses said any man who crossed her radius went into an uncontrollable rage, like they couldn't help themselves. Violence poured out of their souls. Not just men, but boys. Not just boys, but kids. Not just kids, but toddlers. "I always suspected something was wrong, but I didn't know," she says. Her eyes are pleading for something. Forgiveness? "Do you believe some people are born evil?" she asks. The detective looks at her with pity. "Tell me." 2. 14 years ago. Sarah, at birth. She didn't cry. She opened her eyes and looked and looked and looked and looked. She was beautiful. All babies are beautiful. Sarah, at 13 weeks. She didn't cry. Not ever. Sarah, at 18 months. Sarah's first word was light. Her sister's had been mama. Sarah, at 19 months. Karina and Patrick fought all the time now. Maybe it was the strain of having two kids instead of one. When it had been just Calliope, things had been easier. If Patrick was too tired, Karina would take over. Maybe take Callie to the playground, or to a Mommy and Me movie. Or, if Karina was the tired one, Patrick took Callie to Kids Paint at the museum, or tricycling around the neighborhood. Now, though, there were no breaks. And Callie was different, too. Needier, shyer, fearful. It was like she'd disappeared into her own skin as soon as Sarah was born. Like she was crouched down and afraid, hiding inside herself and watching her baby sister. One night, after both girls were asleep, Karina dared to say the words she'd been thinking for 19 months. "Honey," she said to Patrick. "Honey, Sarah is so..." Here she struggled to come up with the right word. So many to choose from. Strange, unusual, different. She forgets now which word she did choose. "Sarah's so blank, isn't she?" "All babies are blank," he said, and rolled away from her in bed. Before Sarah, they used to curl around each other and chat themselves to sleep, her head on his shoulder, his hand on her thigh. Not these days, though. Most nights he was silent. Most nights he slept with his back turned to her. He was tired. He was always tired. Karina told